Welcome to Shouldn't Have Come, a podcast about how Australia's the greatest country on earth and the First Fleet were heroes. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that's, it's not entirely what we were after, but, like, that was pretty good. Yay, Simon!
Hit
yay.
The theme song!
I mean, you know, people are entitled to their sexual proclivities, you know. I mean, let there be a thousand blossoms bloom. But I ain't spending any time on
Hi everyone. I've got Simon out of the chair. It's fine now. Is that all tightly strapped in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't get out.
All right, and we've learned our lesson about the First Fleet.
They were bad.
Thank you, Simon. But you know, it's funny you bring up moving around in tourism, because today we're going to talk about Australian tourists.
A group of Australian tourists has been caught on video misbehaving in Fancy That. They're seen abusing locals, relieving themselves in public, and generally running wild.
Karen, I think Simon, actually, you were the first one of you two to go overseas, right?
When did you go?
In a year 9 trip to France.
Oh, shit. Well, yeah, no, you beat me by like a decade.
Fuck. Also, hi, I'm Simon.
Oh, right, we're going to introduce...
Oh, shit, right, yeah, that's Simon.
So this is Simon. He edits some of the episodes and is a comedy writer and a very old, very dear friend of mine.
Yeah, that's
Simon,
me.
Do you want to plug your stuff now?
I mean, there's not too much to plug. I guess you
all
can
right,
just...
All right, cool, we'll move on.
Get his ass!
Simon's written for such sites as Hard Drive, among others, and is available for hire for so many tasks.
Non-sexual. Well, I mean, depends on the rate. You know, we can negotiate.
And is also a stand-up comedian, MC, host, general comic creative, has fantastic hair right now, great mullet, great facial hair. And is visiting from Canberra for a couple of days. So we're having a guest episode, I suppose, with Simon here. We might do a couple while we're there, but you'll be hearing this one at least first. And I'm obviously Yanni. Hi, Karen.
Oh, hi, Yanni. And hi, Simon.
Hello. We haven't talked since, like, I got here until right now.
Yeah, it's crazy. How you been, man?
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah. And that's how friendship goes.
So, on the topic of friendship, Simon, you went to France. Did you make lifelong friends?
No. I spent most of the time trying to charm a classmate who I later went on two very awkward dates with.
Hell yeah. Okay.
Congratulations.
And, Karen, the first time you went overseas, you were an adult. And
yes,
you went
yeah.
to Europe with Contiki. Do you want to tell
did.
Us about some of the things you did there?
Gosh, what didn't I do there? I'll tell you what, I didn't take care of my liver there. I drank a lot of the time. I spent a lot of time hungover. Did some nice things, though. Okay, let me think. Have you ever been hungover in the Swarovski Crystal Museum in Switzerland? Because I have, and it's like a fever dream. Everything is sparkling, and I felt so ill, and I swore I was going to throw up, like, beside this bedazzled zebra. It was fucked.
And where did you wake up on your birthday?
I woke up in a bridge, not in a bridge, on a bridge in Venice, with a friend desperately trying to get me up.
So that's a classic Australians in Europe trip. Now, Karen, well, actually, Simon, have you ever been to Asia?
No, I have not, even though I did do a degree in a Bachelor in Asian Studies. I started my degree at pretty much the worst time for any kind of overseas travel, the year 2020.
I don't remember what happened that year.
Yeah, just flights were really expensive.
Yeah. Funny you mentioned.
Just haven't really gotten the opportunity. I would really like to go to Japan or South Korea, maybe. But yeah, as of yet, no.
And Karen, have you ever been to... Okay, Archie, you can't be knocking on the door.
Who is it?
Karen, where'd you go in Asia the first time you went to Asia as an Australian tourist?
I went to India.
And what were you meant to be doing there?
I was meant to, and to be fair, I did do a short program on filmmaking and the film industry in India, which was very, very cool. There was a bit of a kerfuffle.
Yeah, what did the boys do that they weren't meant to do?
Okay.
Oh, I remember this story.
Should I start? So historically, some of the previous cohort certainly did get into a lot of illicit things, including both people and substances. And then when we arrived, we proceeded to, I suppose, get rowdy in a very Australian fashion. I was like, what, 21 at the time?
Classic.
A lot of alcohol, a reasonable amount of weed. And
pull a ganja up there.
Yeah, ganja. And two of my fellow travellers got really wasted one night and decided to climb a water tower in the middle of the night, which caused a big issue for the local community, who desperately tried to get them down. And they nearly got kicked out of the program.
The program's been discontinued, right?
For the educational facility that I was a part of, yes.
Because the hotel and everyone...
The hotel complained,
the film people complained.
The film people complained, the locals complained, everyone was pissed off.
Were there guns?
In the group before us, yes, apparently firearms had been waved around.
Harder drugs than weed?
Certainly.
Sex workers?
Yes.
Yeah, damn. And that's pretty classic, Australians going to Asia. That's just what the fuck, you know? Like, Australian tourism is kind of inherently damaging.
Police say it was actually 20 small bottles of vodka before allegedly fly-kicking an innocent stranger from his scooter. He's then accused of ambushing a grandfather and throwing him from his own porch, chasing terrified guests at a boarding house and slamming aside the operator who came to help.
We're not even going to talk about the dead biological matter that is burned in the process of getting us off this island, even if we're just going to Bali or Mumbai to indulge in some colonial-era larrikinism. I decided to Google Australian tourist crime in Bali, and there's an article from an hour before I wrote this about a bunch of Australians beating up some security guards.
Oh, how fun!
Yeah, at a bar. And another one from a week ago about a fake fucking meme coin that Australians keep losing money on in Bali. I call that reparations.
Honestly, and we deserve it 100%.
Yeah, like...
100%.
You already deserved it, and then when you bought the Bali meme coin, you deserved it more.
But it's called Bintang.
Most people come here for a Bintang and be amongst it. Bintang over here. How much is a Bintang? $3.50 for a Bintang.
But, you don't even need to go international. Even domestic tourism is racked with the worst of colonial-based instincts. Looking at the UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Australia, there is one big standout in terms of gross. Uluru.
Welcome to Uluru, Australia's iconic natural wonder.
Have you all ever been?
No, I wish I had been back when I was still allowed to trample on it with my white feet. Now I will never get that opportunity, unless I decide to do it anyway, which I will be reprimanded for, but probably be fine because of who I am as a person.
That's pretty much what I was going to get to. Yeah. That's how Uluru was treated for a long time. There's loud calls to bring the climbing Uluru back.
We're all entitled to rock as Australians.
But not yet. I also forgot, sorry, probably what stands out the most, the brightest, the bleachest one is the Great Barrier Reef. Although the impact of physical tourism damage, which is there, a lot of the reefs are damaged by people just stepping on them. It's probably dwarfed by the coral bleaching, and that's, you know, we can't completely blame that on tourism.
I feel like we shouldn't call it coral bleaching either. I feel like we should just call it like coral death.
Yeah,
it's what's happening, right?
I don't really know how coral works. Like, I don't know if the Great Barrier Reef is just like one organism.
My nan's named Coral, and she's still alive, so I find death offensive.
Okay, but is your grandmother bleached?
I haven't asked.
Have you bleached your grandmother? Just out of interest. Hey, friends, do you bleach your grandmother?
I mean, her hair's white.
It's all adding up.
Simon's grandmother is one of UNESCO's World Heritage Sites in Australia. Like, and another one is...
Yeah, you've seen Simon's nan?
And another one is... I'm sorry, Coral. I've never met you. Like, I just... You know, I don't have any grandparents. I haven't had grandparents since I was a kid. White people always have, like, one grandparent till they're 30. It's so straight.
I got two, baby.
Nice for some. I have one.
Jackie, hope you're well. Kakadu National Park. The National Park's tourism body. So this has recently been UNESCO'd. And so they're working with Kakadu's traditional owners to ensure that the booming tourism is culturally appropriate and environmentally safe. Tourism body's working with the Gunjami Aboriginal Corporation, which is the body that represents the traditional Mirar owners, and they're demolishing a town in the middle of Kakadu that's primarily inhabited by members of the Kunwinchu language group. Though the Coowinchu's traditional lands are elsewhere in the state, the families have been living in the town of Jabiru since the 80s. And although the, as far as I can tell, white CEO of the Gunjemi Corporation says the houses already demolished were unsafe, and the Mirar do want to look after everyone who's on their land, they do want to turn it into a tourism hotspot, so the longer-term plan is actually not to have residents there. The largely indigenous, and many of whom are disabled retirees who live in Jabiru, are not being consulted.
Gosh, what a surprise. What a huge surprise.
And the sites that are on the UNESCO heritage list are just the ones that survived the initial purges. Like, tourism, any tourism, in my opinion, because I'm a mean bitch, but Australian domestic tourism to these sorts of places threatens to eat away at the survival of the few remaining relatively untouched sites of cultural significance. And that takes us to the main topic of our episode today. Space-wise, we are going to the UNESCO World Heritage Site closest to Brisbane. But to get there, we are, as usual, gonna take a trip through time.
Whoa!
Oh my god! What year is this?
Simon, take a guess what year we are.
Well, gee willikers, sir. I said sir.
Oh, I didn't realize you were. I thought you were speaking to Karen.
Fuck.
No, that's fine. Don't, no.
You piece of shit. You fucking dog.
Being misgendered on my own podcast.
I haven't done that in like 5 years.
You're in character.
I'm in character.
It's old timey. Come on.
I'm in character as a ignorant white man.
Yeah, okay. And what year? What year are we in, do you think? And what
2025.
Crushing it.
Karen, do you want to guess how far back we're going?
1930s.
Further.
1920s.
Further.
1910s.
Further.
1810s.
Further.
1710s.
Further.
1610s.
Let me know when you want me to tell you.
60,000 years.
Too far.
10,000 years.
You're flying into the next stop on your work trip. It's about 20,000 years ago, and your boss, Enrico, has asked you to survey some far-off system for ghosts, life, understanding, the works. So far, it's been a quiet experience. Aside from some adorable lava critters, you've mainly been asking questions of rocks, dust, and rock dust. This planet seems at least interesting, with a mixed material surface of mostly fluid water with some pockets of shifting solid land and ice. You check a monitor to see where you're going to touch down. After your experience climbing out of the big gas planet in the solar system, even landing in the middle of an ocean would be a relief. There's just some smells you can't get off your skin. Thankfully, it seems this time you're going to be landing somewhere solid. A sizable island juts off the eastern coast of a southern continent, looking for all money like a hangnail. You turn your map overlay off to get a clear view of the place, and your breath is stolen by some of the densest, deepest, greenest rainforests you've ever seen. Pockets of bright, white, pristine sand dot the coastline between flowers? Is that... You realize this isn't going to be a normal stop, and you get a couple hundred meters away as your ship's brakes counterboost, and you frantically calibrate your communication module. Whatever is down there, apparently, some of it is self-locomoting. Some of it is covered in scales, some in fur, and some are covered in skin? Ew. You were hoping to never have to deal with that again. See, most of the life that moves around that you've met in your travels has been at the extremes of the universe. Molten mites, frozen frogs, antimatter ants, and the Cloindarks. There's certainly been some thick, mossy plant matter here and there, but as you step out of your ship, you're looking at goddamn trees packed together in a thick canopy. It's fucking beautiful. As you glide along, you take a moment to enjoy the sand swirling around your exhausts. Your ship's been doing some scans in the background, and it seems like this entire island is made of sand. The ponds in the interior, these round pockets of calm, tell you everything you need to know about what's above you. You put your upcoming meeting with the skin beings out of your mind as you enjoy an unexpected, hopefully easy job. You've obviously generated some odd looks from the inhabitants. Well, not the trees, they seem not to care, but other than the small furry ones that yip and yap, these creatures seem to trust your aura. Most of them use a mixed value communication architecture, some charming combination of grunts, actions, and context that seems to keep everyone going. Some of the flyers are chirpers, which is certainly going to be of delight to Enrico, who has a pet theory that all chirpers are flyers. You don't want to tell him, but they're so cute you can't not tell him. A biped walks up to you, one of the skin beings, and you brace yourself for the smell. However, these ones aren't anything like the typical skin beings of the universe. Unlike, say, the Coindarks, these skin beings expel their waste rather than accumulating it for heft. Also unlike the Coindarks, who largely communicated through pus, these ones seem to have a partially language-verbal-based system. Finally, you can have a conversation, and they are lovely. I mean, you have the latest aura, but they've been able to perceive your real shape, and they've taken it in stride like adults do. They tell you that the island you are on was intentionally created to be a self-sustaining ecosystem, and losing yourself wandering the coast, you believe them. Hours later, you're heads down in a sand dune, airing out your exhausts and sleeping outside of your spaceship for once. You've obviously got lots to do on this planet, but right here, here is where you realized why you signed up to do this. This is a perfect island with flyers, walkers, growers, and swimmers. You even thought you saw a jumper through the trees, but that's tomorrow's adventure. There's no meteorite, there's no angel investor or mining system that's disrupting this balance, condemning the planet to an inevitable future of decay. Your ship finishes all its scans and gives you the all clear. No one on the planet poses a major destabilizing threat. You let out a blurb of relief. As much as you hated every hour you spent with the Coindarks, growing and maintaining pustules to use in heated discussions, destroying their weird skin planet isn't a memory you hold dear. But it's the part of the job they don't tell you about, the difficult things that have to be done. But here? None of that. This is paradise. There's a cord between all the complex beings. The walkers tell you that they have three key laws. The land comes first, if you have plenty, you must share, and everything that can be must remain untouched. Enrico is going to be thrilled to hear about this. It's the flyers that tell you about the nature of the land you're on, but it's one of the bipeds you meet that use the word that you liked most. Welcome to Kagari.
So I tuned out for a sec. Could you repeat all that?
Oh my god. Okay, I'm coming in to say that was magical. I was transported.
I'm glad you liked it, husband.
God damn it, Simon. All right, so Kagari.
Yeah. Kagari is a tiny little island that juts off the east coast of Australia, and people have been there for somewhere between 5 and 50,000 years. That's nice.
Shit.
Yeah. And Australians, however, and when I say Australians, you know who I mean.
I've never... The real Australians.
Shit for brains.
Shit for brains.
Let's do it once again. Shit for brains.
Shit for brains.
That's better.
Yeah, the people just like Simon.
Yeah. Australians like Simon have never not fucked around on and violently misidentified Kagari. When James Cook sailed by on the SS Hang In There, members of the Bajala, Dulingbara, and Gugu Yimithir ran along the beach to keep a close eye on this strange giant sea craft. Cook decides that this island's called Indian Head.
I'm sorry, why?
Because James Cook is the dumbest dumb guy ever.
I name it Indian Head.
Oh, they were calling Aboriginal people Indian at that point.
Why does every, like, white colonist think they're in India? Like, wherever they go to, they're like, oh, I'm in India now.
I can answer this question if you'd like. But also, yeah, we can just roll with that. They only knew about one brown, and it was Indians. And so when they saw other browns, they were like, Indians.
They're like, oh, shit, India!
But we're not talking about India today. And this is one of the earliest Australian Indigenous interactions. And according to A History of Queensland by Raymond Evans, afterwards, the people composed a song to commemorate the strange event, the oldest preserved Indigenous observation of the British incomers. It depicts the strangers as burying themselves like the sand crabs and disappearing like smoke, which I assume means they were too scared to leave the coast and they lit bonfires and dug potholes and trenches.
We're guys. We keep a little dirt under my pillow for the birdman.
Yeah, fair enough. They're just like, oh, batten down the hatches.
It took about 9 days from contact for the first Australian tourists to fully wear out their welcome. What's your record, Simon?
I mean, I'd say about 10 minutes into this podcast, probably happened.
And that's our Simon. He's an overachiever.
Well, you haven't done anything as bad as what Cook and his boys were doing. Aside from the 96 kilograms of fish that they'd consumed each day, they were also enjoying the butchery of kangaroos and pigeon, the harvesting of yam and kale, and the catching of 12 giant turtles and keeping them on the boat.
Sorry, how much? How many fish was that?
96 kilograms per day.
Per day?
Yeah, so in 9 days, they're at, 870-ish.
Jesus Christ. And they're just, this is what happens every time, like, a ye old world British or European dude, basically a white dude, goes to a new country. They just fucking eat everything there. They just fucking eat all of it.
And they try to keep that, because they were just keeping the turtles on the boat.
And like, they keep eating them, right?
Yeah. Well, they're eating the turtles, but they're also like, oh, we'll take some of these turtles back to England, put them in the fucking whatever, the museum. Turtles famously take a long time to get back to the British Museum because apparently they taste so good. Darwin famously, like, he kept going to the Galapagos being like, all right, this time, and they take more and more turtles, and they'd always eat them all on the way back.
You haven't lived until you've tried turtle.
You know, so I imagine that was what was to come for these turtles. And one of the locals tries to explain, like, hey, at least give us one of those turtles back. Like, you shouldn't have any of them, but at least give us one of them back. And Cook fucking shoots him.
Holy fuck.
The Gugulmithir people make the wise decision of staying away from these maniacs, which is a great idea. Because Cook's crew have a habit of raping any women they could wherever they went. And one of them, Joseph Banks of the suburb in Canberra and three suburbs in Sydney, writes in his journal that he was straining to the utmost to see young women more naked than our mother Eve.
Sir Joseph Banks is a great figure in British science, and he went on to Cook's first expedition around the world.
So
Banks tries to follow some Gugulmithir people back to their place to hopefully meet some chicks with, like, his friend who, like, the two of them had done this with a bunch of Tahitian women already. Plenty of times. And Banks is really confused as to why they made signs to make us understand that they did not desire our company.
Why are you sending such mixed signals? You're throwing these spears at us and
But they're naked, you see.
Yeah, it's so mixed signals. Like, I don't get it.
Your face is so unhappy, but your breasts look marvelous. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's them. They never catch any of them, and Cook and Banks leave Kigari after a while. They're still calling it Indian Head, because of course they are, but at some point it is renamed to Great Sandy Island. And I'm going to give them credit, that's at least useful, because it is the largest sand island in the world.
So what is a sand island? Is it just, it's literally just like
a bunch of sand collects somewhere.
Sandbank that just grows shit now?
Yes.
So you said it's the largest sand island?
Yes.
Then it should be called Greatest Sandy Island.
They should call it Greatest Sandy Island. Well done, Simon. I was like, he's not asking a question because he needs clarification. Like,
of course not.
They should call it Greatest Sandy. I don't know if they knew it was the largest. So sand islands are most common around Australia. Sand basically sifts into a place over time and builds up, and bits of vegetation that are washing up the coast keep washing in. It creates this really thick, like, moss, essentially, that forms kind of the core of the what holds the vegetation onto the sand. Great Sandy Island, the greatest sandy island, Kigari, is credited by some as the reason the Great Barrier Reef exists, because it cuts sand off from part of the eastern coast of Australia.
Oh, shit.
And, like, parts of the bigger waves or whatever, and it... Yeah, it's... I mean, obviously, no one fucking knows. We're talking about, like, when our alien friend was here. Like, we weren't there. Another good name is the Coral Sea, which is the sea that they're in, because there's all the coral reefs there.
And my man.
And Simon's nan. And some of the coral reefs have a name that hopefully raises the eyebrows of any captain charting these waters. The wreck reefs.
I came in like a wrecking ball.
Yeah. No, that's not where you typically want to put a ship. But, you know, maybe it's a misnomer.
Well, in May of 1836, Captain James Fraser was commanding the brig, the Stirling Castle, up the east coast of Australia. He had already shipwrecked on the wreck reefs once in 1830. So it was probably a questionable decision to give him another ship to captain, but somebody had to move all that liquor from Sydney to Singapore.
So he's like, I've wrecked it once, I'm going for the record.
world-class wrecking crew. That's our boy. This James Fraser is not of the Fraser of the suburb in Canberra. Different guy. Because he's mainly known for wrecking these two ships.
What a legacy.
James's crew and his pregnant wife, Eliza, again, they're transporting liquor. They're wasted. They crash on the reefs. And he becomes the first Australian to be shipwrecked twice in Australia. So the crew get away from the Stirling Castle in some lifeboats. But Eliza has to do most of James's work because Captain James has gout and an ulcer.
And she's fucking pregnant. What do you mean?
Well, not for long, because she has her baby into the ocean and it dies immediately.
Jesus Christ!
Because of the stress brought on, the crew then get to Great Sandy Island. It takes them about a week, just like sailing up and down the coast and running out of food to finally dock, because they're so scared of meeting the locals. And once they finally dock, the rest of the crew just leave the Frasers. It's like, you guys are... We don't want to deal with you. And they just go off and are fine. Like, they're pretty much fine. So they're just the Frasers and just a couple of the, like, more infirm people who are stuck to face the natives, as it were. And Captain Fraser dies pretty quickly, with most of the survivors chalking it up to the guy being mostly dead anyway.
I'm sorry.
I mean, that'll get you.
But The Bajala do try their best to save him. It's like they don't know how to deal with it. They're like, we've never met as fat a man as this. Like, no one here has ever gorged themselves for 20 years. But yeah, he dies, and they've just kind of stuck with Eliza and a couple other people. So Eliza Fraser, his wife, who's just had a kid into the ocean. At first, they treat her as like an honored guest. So they have like corroboree. It's, you know, they talk to her. But eventually they start regarding her as somewhere between a madwoman, mentally unwell, a she-ghost, or a straight-up reincarnated demon.
Sounds like my ex-wife.
Yak, 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 yak.
Get back, witch!
I'm not a witch, I'm your wife!
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that how, like, it feels to welcome any kind of, like, person very different from you into your life? You're just like, wow, this is so interesting. Wow, this is so cool. And then after a bit, you're just like, oh, you're a fucking freak.
She's a fucking... She's Scottish. So she's not, like, she's, like, born in Scotland.
She's a freak.
I put a stake through her heart and garlic around her neck to make sure she never comes
back. Yeah, you didn't add the Scottish thing, like, that... The demon thing is, like, 100% true, then. Like, that's just a biological fact.
Yeah, James Fraser was married to a demon named Eliza. The situation is obviously tense, but she is kept in good health. Like, they give her food and shelter. They, like, try to get her to, like, you know, work with them, be part of their community, and she's not having it. So they're just like, all right, we have your crazy lady. And eventually, the government hears about the missing liquor and the people. And they send a rescue team, including a weirdly qualified person they had on hand. Now, John Graham was an Irishman. So, get excited.
Hell yeah.
And he'd been sent to Australia because he stole 7 kilograms of hemp.
Hell yeah.
Then, once he got to Sydney, he became really close with a lot of Indigenous people there and started causing trouble by trying to, like, resist and stuff, so they sent him to Brisbane. Once he gets to Brisbane, he runs away to... Kuthabara, where he becomes part of a Gubi Gubi community. He becomes known as Moilo, and he marries a widow named Mamba. He becomes fluent in the language, and, like, he lives there. And this is actually a very common story. There's a lot of early convicts who just, well, I'm not staying here. Those guys seem fine, and they're just chill. It's fine. They get along well. They marry into the community. It's weirdly common and unreported.
Well, yeah, I mean, that kind of happens when you have a prison island.
Yeah, I guess.
Like, what are you going to pick? Like, the people who are also getting, like, beaten and killed and mistreated by the same people you are, or are you going to be with the people who fucked you over in the first place?
Yeah, like, it's...
Like...
It becomes very...
An easy decision.
Exactly. If that's allowed to develop, you'd get some kind of, you know, probably coalition between people.
I wonder what, like, an Indigenous Australian language sounds like with an Irish accent.
That's the thing that I was most... I don't have... Obviously, this is so long ago, but, like, John Graham, I think, is the Australian figure that I want to meet most. Because it sounds like he's fluent in, a few... It's a similar language group, but he's able to communicate with a lot of different people. He seems like a classic rabble-rouser. People seem to like him. It seems like he just, like, falls in love with this woman, Mamba, because he, like, has just stayed with Mamba for 6 years, and then she dies, and he leaves. Like, that's it. He's just like, oh, like... I've fallen and, like, this is my person. And then she's gone, he's bereft, he goes back to Brisbane, and now he's part of the rescue party. So you kind of got to take him. He's the one white dude who speaks these languages. And he's negotiating Eliza's release with the Bajala people, and everyone's safe. Eliza remarries a different sea captain who happens to be James Fraser's cousin. And thankfully, she goes back to England with her new husband. And that is where the story would end, if it weren't for some embellishments that Eliza made over the course of the rest of her life. Do you want me to read these to you, or do you want to read them? Because you might enjoy reading them.
I'm sure.
Feature Simon.
Oh, maybe I don't want to say these. All right. I don't think I do want to be on recording saying these.
Let me just, the Bajala people who look after her are violent savages. The Bajala savages take the Frasers captive as slaves and strip them naked. The Bajala spear James to death because he can't carry a whole tree fast enough.
No, he was just dead already.
The women of the island, jealous of Eliza's white skin, stopped her from being with her husband as he lay dying from the spear wound.
You know.
Somehow, she's still able to cradle his head, blood spurting out of his mouth as she hears him say his last words. Eliza, I am gone forever.
As last words go, not really that special.
Just kind of factual.
Yeah.
On the topic of factual...
I'm dying.
The savages become cannibals and they eat her dead husband. The savage cannibals torture...
You can't eat that dude, he's all fat.
You're gonna get sore tummies, don't do it.
Have some nice turtle.
The savage cannibals torture her, beat her, make her sleep outside in the rain, and eat roots from the ground. And she also pretends that she never got remarried, and she raises a bunch of money for charity because her kids now don't have a father, and then she defrauds the government a couple of times, and then so does her husband. And these people are trash, and she gets hit by a fucking carriage and dies, and I'm glad that he lost all her money. Fucking business shit. Fuck Eliza Fraser.
Okay, so she's just fully fucking
she
insane.
Is a she's a lying fabulist who... earning a lot of money telling these stories.
Well, yeah, fair. She's doing the tabloid shit, I guess. Like, exactly. Ye olde tabloid shit.
Exactly. Miranda Otto, of all people, comes into this story because she played Eliza Fraser in a documentary once, and she read Eliza's original work. She describes it this way. I was surprised by how much of Eliza's testimony was remarkably silly. She'd really tried to make it into a sexy kind of story and chose to play fast and loose with the truth, to write a bodice ripper type of story. She wanted to make it quite salacious. There are plenty of other witnesses to these events. The Bajala have histories from the time, and the Frasers aren't even the only white people there. There's the other people who got away. There's John Graham. There's a second white dude who has been living with indigenous people. Everyone else agrees on the broad story of events I told you before the cannibal murderer cult situation. But Eliza Fraser's fake testimony is what takes off. The island gets renamed Fraser Island, and the savage natives that we talked about are about to see the brunt of the Australia machine. Cattle grazing, frontier wars, internment camps, abducted kids, logging, then they used it for bombing practice. But the reputation that the Bajala gained for cannibalism and savagery, again, made up by a literal circus attraction, helped keep the tourists away.
Fuck, that's nuts. Like, just from this one testimony.
That she, like, keeps adding onto?
Well, yeah, she's just like, oh, and actually, I had to sleep in the dirt. When I was sleeping in the dirt, they set the dirt on fire. Oh, and actually, when the dirt was on fire, they also made me do the alphabet, but in reverse, and it was really hard.
Look, I don't want to lose sight of the superstructure that allows this stuff to happen. Western tourists are more of a death knell than an early symptom of colonial destruction. Because first, they go to punish you for whatever they've decided to punish you for, and then they name your home after the person who ruined your life, and then they bring tents. I'm going to call the island Kigari throughout when I'm referring to it, but there are some quotes and organizations that we'll refer to that use the Fraser Island name that was in place since 2023, especially if I'm referring to like a contemporary news source. So, once the value of logging and sand mining were down in Kigari, the local tourism starts popping off in earnest. In 1992, much of Kigari was listed as a World Heritage Site, the UNESCO thing from earlier, and the backpackers of Europe start filing in. From less than 5,000 yearly visitors in 1970, about 100,000 people are visiting the island each year from the heritage listing in 1992. That grows by about 5% per year to something like 130,000 in 1996, with the growth split by independent tourers, who tend to stay longer and cause more damage, and commercial tourers, who bring way more people but usually only stay for a couple of hours. I felt compelled to write about how beautiful Kigari is here, to extend an olive branch to all our listeners sympathetic to Australian tourism, but fuck you guys. Oh my god. If you go to australia.com, the official website of Tourism Australia, they say the top thing to do is swim in an essential oil-infused lake, and the second is hit exciting four-wheel drive tracks. The lake they're talking about, Lake Mackenzie, is so acidic that most fish species can't survive in it, and the sand is so pure that it naturally exfoliates your skin. I'll send you a picture, Kieran, of the lake, and you guys can look at it. Just, it is a beautiful lake.
And it's just, like, naturally that acidic?
Yeah, because the sand filters everything.
Shit.
It's
okay.
Fully clean water. So, like,
fuck.
Animal life, bacteria can't survive in it.
Holy shit. Yeah, that actually looks absolutely like every idealistic kind of tourism shot you can imagine.
Yeah, it's just like very, very blue, very, very clear water.
And that's just like an iPhone photo. That's not even a professional photo. Do you want to swim in that water?
Yeah, I do actually. I mean, I don't know how good it would be for me, but like looking at it in the heat that we're currently in, it looks so good.
It looks real good, yeah.
It'd be good for you. But the Bajala people who called it Burangura, which means something like waters of wisdom, didn't swim in it at all. It was their source of fresh water. They used it for drinking, and it was also regarded as a place to make decisions. In some tellings, it's one of the eyes of Kigari, the goddess whose body makes the island. It's heavily advised not to wear any sunscreen, use soap, or have any oils on your body, as it will damage the fragile ecosystem of the lake.
And I'm sorry, you said that one of the recommendations of Tourism Australia is to have an essential oil bath in this fucking lake?
Yeah, where the bloody hell are you?
Fuck.
What are your thoughts on SPF? Would you swim in that lake without sunscreen?
Yeah, I would, but that's because I live life on the edge and I'm lazy.
Do you think Australian tourists are remembering their SPF on Lake Mackenzie?
Surely not.
I don't know. I feel like they probably would.
Yeah.
Which is bad, hey. In this instance.
Yeah, the water's changing color. Talking about damaging the fragile ecosystem, to get to Lake Mackenzie, you need to take a four-wheel drive across the island. Tourism Australia says that even the driving process is a highlight of Kigari. And they've got a picture of one of their exciting four-wheel drive tracks that, again, I'll send it to you.
Okay, so looking at this, this is just straight up along the beach?
Yeah, it's just cars on the beach.
Like, it's just straight up along, and the beach looks gorgeous.
It's like the flattest, smoothest sand I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, with just massive fucking tire tracks, like, carved through it.
Yep, it's a car on the beach behind another car on the beach. It almost feels like an insult to my, your, the listener's intelligence to have to describe why it's bad to drive an air-conditioned death machine across a fragile island made of sand. The Fraser Island Defenders Organization, FIDO, describes the basic destruction of the driving itself, the killing of vegetation, birds, frogs, and oysters, the medium-term destructive impacts of the facilitation of driving, reducing the vegetation space, creating these divots which water pools in, which is destroying the structure of the island, and the long-term cumulative impacts of the millions of cars. The elevation of much of the island has dropped many meters.
Ooh.
So if you're driving a four-wheel drive on Kigari and you crash and die, you earned it, fuck you.
Yeah, you're fucking sinking the island. Use your goddamn legs like an adult.
But you can't. It's too big.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no.
What do you think sinking the island more? All that four-wheel driving or that fat fuck James Fraser?
Yeah, do we have any analysis about how much the island shrunk at the time of the shipwreck?
They thought it was a crater. And for a long time, scientists were trying to date it. And they were like, it seems like this meteor hit like 20 years ago, but we don't remember that.
And they're like, oh my God, it's a belly button.
A fauna I didn't mention earlier is the dingo. And that's probably what Kigari's most known for. The Kigari or Fraser Island, but Kigari dingoes are beautiful. Listener, Google Kigari dingo and try to scroll past all the pictures of them with shock collars on. They don't quite look like, I think, the dingo you have in mind.
That's lovely.
Aww.
Look at that dingo. Hanging out on the white sands, enjoying. He's got gorgeous eyes, tan colour, kind of typical of dingoes. It's got some variations in there, some kind of lighter patches, some darker patches.
That just looks
the
like,
eye makeup game on point.
That just looks like a, I don't know, like a German Shepherd or some type. Like, it looks like just a regular kind of big dog. Like, it doesn't look like any kind of savage animal.
No, they're beautiful, and they're actually, like, they were for a long time thought to be the most dingo around. Because the original dingo came from Asia with people about 5,000 years ago, and took over as the apex predator in the ecosystem. They pushed animals like the thylacine off the mainland continent, which is why there's animals like the Tasmanian tiger, the extant Tasmanian tiger, and the Tasmanian devil. Like Tasmania, Kigari is an isolated island, but dingoes made it there 5,000 years ago. This means they haven't had as much interbreeding with the dogs that Europeans ended up bringing over that many mainland dingoes have. And so they're often called the purest dingoes. It's not exactly true. There's some pockets of mainland dingoes that haven't been bred with dogs too much, but they're certainly very genetically distinct from dingoes, and they're so, so, so cute. So,
Yanni just dropped her phone.
Cute dink. They're so cute. I was like, wow, and I threw my phone. Couldn't control myself. So these dingoes are all around the island, and the Bajala knew two types of dingoes. There were Wata, which were camp dingoes, and Wangari, which are wild dingoes. The relationship with Wata was basically like our relationship with dogs. There's companionship, protection, hunting. Oh my god, look at them. The relationship with Wangari was more like our relationship with foxes, wild, omnivorous scavengers that tend to be fine if left alone. Kigari Ranger, Conway Burns, who's a Bajala man, describes Wangari this way. Wangari have been and always should be wild. They are a natural and important part of the ecosystems on Kigari. Bajala Rangers perform smoking ceremonies for Wangari that die by fault of humans. This sends them home to Sky Country, where Biral is waiting with a message through the smoke, to ensure their spirit doesn't walk in limbo without an understanding of what happened to them. When the last of our people were taken off the island, all of the dingoes became Wangari. We, the Bajala, are still strongly connected to them in our hearts, minds, and spirits.
Damn, so they've basically got two types of dingo. You've got the kind of wild dingo, essentially, which is just like, hey, we don't fuck with it. It doesn't fuck with us. This is just another part of nature, just like any other animal.
Just like us.
And then they have the more domesticated kind of dog dingo, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, they're described like as dogs, like they sleep with the people, they live there. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
So tourism didn't initially cause a problem for Wangari because Australians do have a healthy fear of dingoes. The thing you're thinking about happened in 1980. And although the trash isn't ideal, the Wangari, like scavenging a packet of chips, behaves the same as a Wangari scavenging rotten fish. Like, they can really eat anything. It's not good for them to be getting all these microplastics, but they haven't changed yet. They haven't started telling people to fuck off yet. Then the tourists start wanting pictures. And if you want a picture with an animal, what do?
You drug it.
If you want a
Okay, what does everybody else do?
I assumed that was where we were going, like with the tigers at the zoo.
Well, you get up close and personal with them, right?
You get up close, you give them some food. And
hey, what's the food got in it?
I guess the food has... No, okay, no one's drugging...
Simon hasn't been yet, so I guess no one's drugging them.
No, but I'm definitely planning a trip after this podcast. It sounds great. It's Can't wait close. To go for a swim. I'll make sure to put on lots of sunscreen.
Go for a drive.
Yeah.
Just drive the car into the lake. Giving them food is very different to scavenging, and predictably, the behavior of Wangari to humans starts changing, because Australians implemented capitalism on them.
You can't do that to an animal. That fucks them up. Look at all of us.
And they understandably reacted by biting the hand trying to feed them shit food for a cute photo.
Honestly, fair enough. Like, fair enough.
Yeah, but obviously people don't take that lying down. Between 1995 and 2000, 40 dingoes were shot on Kigari after being aggressive towards humans. Since Azaria Chamberlain's death in 1980, most dingo attacks have been on Kigari, with about half of them being children and a few of them leading to deaths. Before anyone gets on their high horses about irresponsible European tourists, although the list does include French, British, German, and volleyball Europeans being attacked.
Volleyball Europeans?
So most of them, they were like a British family, a German person, and then it was just like, Europeans playing volleyball.
Viva Volleybolia.
And a Wangari just runs out from the trees and just grabs one of them by the head or something. Earned it. But it is mostly just Australians doing it. If you go to Kigari and your kid gets bitten like a dingo, that is your fault. Fuck you. The massacre of 30 dingoes after they killed a kid in 2001. Fuck you. That's your fault. Don't go there. Don't shoot Wangari with a spear gun like happened 2 weeks ago. Nobody is making you go to Kigari. Darren Blake has been a Kigari ranger for more than 10 years. At first, they only had to do the occasional smoking ceremony. It's sorry business, and the process of comforting a Wangari while sending them to the Sky Country is emotionally racking. And during COVID, he was probably the happiest he's ever been. They hadn't had to have a smoking ceremony in over 3 years when the wackiness of 2024 crashed into Darren. By mid-year, he was doing one every 6 weeks. And even if you went to Kigari for 3 hours and you didn't see one of these dingoes, this is your fault. All of you stop going to Kigari. And don't light fires either. You don't know how they work. You live in Rosenthal Heights, or Brisbane, or Warwick, and you have no business camping on a sandy island and setting a fire that burns for 7 weeks.
So far, 80,000 hectares have been scorched.
A fire that, unlike the frequent controlled burnings that the Bajala do, burnt
half of Gari.
What the fuck? Sorry, when was this?
I think last year, or maybe the late the year before. I think it actually crossed 2 years. But this was just happening. But don't worry. They reopened tourism while the island was still burning.
Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up.
I mean, what a photo for your Insta, though. Like, a burning island behind you. Like, you gotta go. You gotta go.
You're gonna get a photo of a Vulpix.
Vulpix's greatest attack. Fire spin. Using powerful flames.
I don't care if you're, like, a model heritage visitor, leave no trace, motherfucker. If you're sitting on the shores of Lake Mackenzie while smoke fills the air, fuck you. I hope you took that time to think about how shithouse your priorities are. Just go to the mall. It's where you belong. Just go to the mall.
Set a fire at the mall.
Set fire to the mall. I watched it burn as I touched the mall. So I obviously, I got very mad writing about the Wurundjeri. Had a little cry. It's what it is. And the next thing we're going to cover is as ecologically devastating as the massacres, but it's way stupider. So I normally get Kieran to read these out, but I'm going to send this to Simon. I'll just read you and I'll send you rather. Archie just fell out of bed. I'll send you a 2009 article from news.com.au.
Fraser Island, one big toilet. Yeah, good start. Camping on Fraser Island adds up to 4.3 kilos of feces and 18.3 liters of urine to every lineal meter of sand on the island's eastern beach wilderness camp zones. Almost all nutrient and fecal levels tested in camping zone groundwater exceeded water quality standards and had the potential to spread diseases. About 90,000 people a year beach camp, with most using the dunes as toilets. Many visitors also duck behind the dunes when fishing or four-wheel driving. Some lakes have gone from blue to bright green because of people urinating, using sunscreens, and vehicle impacts. Rangers have the unenviable task of picking up what they euphemistically call paper daisies, pieces of toilet paper left to blow around. Some people don't even bury it. Sustainability Minister Kate Jones said every visitor had a responsibility to look after their own waste. This is a World Heritage Area and should be respected, she said. I'm considering making portaloos mandatory. Kieran has just had
I'm space going
in his hands the entire time.
I'm going through every stage of grief. I'm not well. That was so fucked. What are you... Okay. Sorry. Sorry, Simon. Can you say again how much shit and piss that was?
Just 4.3 kilos of feces and 18.3 liters of urine to every lineal meter of sand on the island's eastern beach.
Feces per meter is not a unit I've used.
You can't do that. What the fuck? What the fuck? You're just shitting out there like dogs.
Somebody not know how to flush a toilet after they've had a shit.
Like, not even, like, a cat with an attitude. You won't even fucking bury it. That's foul. That's foul. That's, like, look, listen, I've taken a piss in places I probably shouldn't have taken a piss. But I've never done that on a fucking UNESCO heritage fucking site. I've done it on a street somewhere.
I've just got the image of, like, someone on this beach, like, you describe them as dogs, and I've got the image literally now of them, like, taking a shit and just, like, dragging their ass along the sand like a dog.
It's so pristine. Well, the sand is a natural exfoliant. I've never been smoother. Danielle, come try this. Oh, my God. Daz is going to love this.
Why? What are you doing over there?
I'm just getting smooth for you, baby.
Oh, God. Let me have a go then. Oh, I just got to... Oh, got to have had a few twoies. Got to leak the old lizard. Might do it over in that lake over there.
Oh, check it out. Looks just like Monster.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I actually hate being a human. Like, this is one of those moments where I wish I could just, like, destroy the very body I reside in and just become a sentient cloud. Like, this is... How do you... How can you have so much disrespect? How can you fathom just being the most feral, foul beast to ever walk the earth?
I don't think they're fathoming much of anything.
No, that's true.
There's only fathoms of shit on the island. So here we are. That was 15 years ago. Visitor numbers have continued to rise since then. If that 3% growth rate in the early 1990s had continued, you'd expect about 400,000 tourists per year by 2019, and that's about right.
Do you know if Sustainability Minister Kate Jones made Portaloos mandatory?
No. But they encourage the use of chemical toilets, which is a portable thing.
Okay, cool. I was about to be like, what the fuck is a chemical toilet?
It's a little portable toilet that, like, composts your shit. That was about, 400,000 per year, and then COVID hits and things get better for a while, but then they got much worse because a lot of tourism seemed to redirect to Cagari. Australia is considered not to be upholding its duties as a heritage protector.
What?
No way. Cagari's ecosystem is at risk of being completely destroyed. The LNP minister has no intentions of capping tourism. He says there already is a cap. The amount of campsites.
Literally just like, well, we haven't filled up every square inch of the island with shit yet, so until then, you can fit so much shit and piss in this bad boy.
The campsites are at about 97% capacity, and they've been at that for years.
And the other 3% is just shit.
Yes.
Honestly, no wonder the dingoes are so fucking mad.
Well,
like, they just, everything on that island, like, they would have so much smell for human, like, and the worst parts of human as well, that when one of them comes towards you offering you something, you're like, oh, great, it's probably another crap that they fucking took on the beach.
On the topic of the dingoes, so Christine Royan, the current secretary of the Bajal Aboriginal Corporation, says that the effective subsidising of tourism to Cagari meant that they might as well just put all the Wangari down and be done with it. Everyone is desperate. And so we get to the article that started my whole side quest. It's from The Guardian. More and more tourists are being attacked by dingoes on Queensland's Cagari. Can it be stopped?
There's a pretty reliable solution, and it's to stop one of these species from interacting with the other. And there's only two ways you can do that.
All right, number one.
Number one. The aforementioned solution. Why don't we just kill all of them?
And number two.
Okay, new solution. Kill all of them.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, yes, there's a really easy way to stop dingo attacks on Cagari, a place where 150 people live. Like, there's very few people who live there. 500,000 or so people go there every year. If you want to go reconnect with nature, do it elsewhere. Just go somewhere else. If you want to poop in compostable bags and bake them to re-eat them or whatever, just stay home. You can do that at home.
You know, here's some I prepared earlier or whatever.
Do a nice shit in your backyard.
Yeah, just do a shit. If you have an apartment, shit on the balcony. Your neighbor will get a present.
Go out there, touch the grass, feel the wind through your pubic hair. Just take a squat in the gentle loam. Lay down a loaf. Feel the steam rise.
A loaf to in meet the loam.
You. A loaf in the loam. Alone, you take a loaf in the loam. Take a load off. Be alone and take a loaf in the loam.
So I think we could solve it, but if you ask Australians, we can't solve it. The health of Australian ecosystems is so far down the list of things that consumers seem to care about. So here's how then Nationals MP and current ambassador to the Vatican, Keith Pitt, put it when they changed the name from Fraser Island to Cagari.
I read ahead and immediately started rolling my eyes. Okay. Arbitrarily renaming cities in Australia isn't just wrong. It makes it really difficult for backpackers and international travellers who are already new to the country. I mean, you can't just go around renaming towns, destroying decades of advertising. There are dozens and dozens of these poor businesses who spend a fortune on advertising, landing pages, websites, Instagram accounts, emails, and everything else that goes along with being in business. They've lost all of that value.
The health of the ecosystem comes below advertising dollars.
Where the bloody hell are ya? I'm confused.
That is Tourism Australia's thing. Anyway, so it's about 10 or so years from now, and you're back. Enrico heard some troubling things about changes in the solar system you went to much earlier in your career. There's been some significant drift, but you're relieved to see Kagari mostly intact. The Paradise Island is still a treasured memory of your middling career, and the tale of the not-smelly skin beings who talked with words have entranced many a dinner party. It wasn't a sure thing that you'd get to see it again, and your hearts swell up with joy as your ship slows and halts. You land on the familiar sandy shores, and a 3,742-kilogram Ram 2500 dual-cab ute slams into you at about 80 kilometers per hour. The $150,000 vehicle with 8-ton towing capacity delivers limousine-like levels of comfort, space, and inclusions, and is the perfect investment to fucking kill an alien. A Wongari rips off part of your weird E.T. flesh while a Swedish man teabags you for a TikTok video. The last thing you see is his yodeling scream as his meatballs are returned to the sea.
Nature is healing.
That's the end of the episode.
Fuck.
Sorry, I wasn't paying attention. Could you repeat all?
I'm never doing creative writing again. I'm never fucking doing creative writing again.
Look,
I get no respect.
Gotta no respect. Hey, what do you think you do? Anyway, Kagari, huh? Yep. What we've done to that place is fucking heinous. That is what we have done, continue to do, and probably will do until it disappears into the sea with all of the fucking Hiluxes and shit turds.
Yeah, when the job's done.
Yeah. When all the animals and all the nature and everything is completely fucked, we'll probably use it as a nuke testing site and just fucking blow it up. And
they tried that. One of the many shipwrecks on the island in World War II was target practice. So they just kept bombing this one part of the island over and over again.
There's no original thought anymore. Like, I can't even come up with an idea that's dirty enough to do that hasn't already been done.
Yeah, I mean, Kagari is going to be the world's largest shitty island. CERN? And that will be a World Heritage Site worth visiting. Any parting thoughts?
Go white people. We did it, guys. We did it again. Nailed it. Shout out to James Fraser. just wrecked by those reefs. Who could have seen it coming? Who could have seen it coming?
No.
Anyone would have done what I did.
I mean, truly a legend, an icon in white history. I mean, what? Gout, an ulcer, and diabetes?
I mean, I feel like if you have the first two, the third is implied.
Yeah, but, you know, to have all three and, but, you like, know, like it's really, really important to the
culture. The gout and the ulcer were the big ones, but everyone's kind of like, he had this, he had this, he had this, he had an STD. Like, he was just dying. He was just like a 60-year-old man with a 30-year-old wife that he picked up, who ends up marrying, like, his mate, and then, well, his cousin, and, like, Eliza, like, she's like in a cage at the zoo just telling this story to people in England, and that's how she makes money.
I'm so sorry, I don't want to make this episode go longer, but she's in a cage in the zoo?
Sorry, at like the circus, but like this is
that's still insane, you know? Yeah. Like
the next cage has a lion in it.
You know, they're like, oh, listen to the crazy lady talk about far off lands.
I think she was displayed next to a kangaroo once in the UK. I think that was something I read.
This is balls to the wall fucking insane.
Yeah. Don't go to Kagari. No one's making you do that.
And if you go to Kagari, I hope you get such a terrible case of constipation that you just fucking explode the minute you leave the island so none of your shit fucking gets on it again.
And follow me on Instagram and Sky at Bower to the People.
Yeah, follow Simon on Instagram. Thank you so much for joining us this episode, Simon. At Bower to the People on Instagram. You can't follow us anywhere, but you can email us shouldn'tacome@gmail.com. It's in the episode description. We'll have a link to Simon's Instagram as well as to the Fraser Island Defenders. I'm not going to promise anything. We're not necessarily going to give. Bye, everyone.